here at KBOO Portland.
KBOO, it's 8:59. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 o'clock, just in a couple of minutes, the Old Mole Variety Hour at 10 on Locus Focus. Barbara Bernstein welcomes Ben Schreiber from Friends of the Earth to talk about Trump's rogues gallery of cabinet picks and the damage they might do to the very agencies they're being tasked to lead. At 11 o'clock, we present the Arctic Report, how the melting Arctic might affect the rest of the world. And at 11:30, it's Voices for the Animals, giving you three compelling reasons to go vegan in the new year. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on donate. Coming up next is the Old Mole Variety Hour. It's 9 o'clock.
Hey, listeners. Due to the holidays, the December KBOO board meeting has been canceled. But don't worry, because we're going to have a makeup meeting between now and the next scheduled board meeting in January. You can go to kboo.fm for more information, or just tune into KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial.
Lord, I wish I was a mole in the ground. I wish I was a mole in the ground. Mine's a mole in the ground, Lord, I root this mountain down. Lord, I wish I was a mole in the ground. I wish I was a mole in the ground. I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM in Rip City, and streaming everywhere at kboo.fm. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour for December 26, 2016. We wish you happy holidays today and remind you that all holidays matter. Today's show looks ahead to the future, in which we will end 2016, end poverty, end alienated labor, end racism, and begin the people's takeover of the city. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. Our engineer is Joe Clement. First up today, Bill Resnick will be talking with David Reamer of the Milwaukee-based Community Advocates Public Policy Institute about policies that could greatly reduce U.S. poverty at modest cost. They also discuss guaranteed annual income, a demo grant, and the crucial role of poor people's self-organization. Then, I'll have a few comments on abolishing not just unemployment, but employment, or at least alienated labor. Denise Morris will share some thoughts on the vexed category of the white working class, and Laurie Mercier and Hyung Nam will be here to talk about the Portland Assembly and other local actions to empower us and improve our lives. And we want you to know about pluginpdx.org as a great resource for resources. If you're part of a local group that's not listed there, you can email them via their website to get included. That's pluginpdx, all one word, .org. As always, you can subscribe to the Old Mole podcast by going to our page on the KBOO website at kboo.fm/program/old-mole-variety-hour, or Old Mole Variety Hour, that works too. And you can also find there links to past shows and segments with further links to even more useful information and some pretty pictures. You can also find links there to help you like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. And you can contact us through that page or on Gmail at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com to let us know what you think and if you'd like to get involved with The Mole, your source for egghead pinko feminist analysis every week. We go first to Bill Resnick and David Reamer.
David Reamer, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Bill. It's good to be with you.
David Reamer is a policy wonk with a big heart. He's studied U.S. social welfare and health programs along the way. He had actually many, if you look at his resume, many prestigious positions, including a legal counsel for Ted Kennedy's subcommittee on health and science research way back then. Recently, he, with others, they've developed a set of programs that would greatly reduce poverty in Wisconsin and, if replicated in the United States, all over the country, of course. We'll be discussing that. Also, how what look like visionary programs, but they're in fact extremely practical. It would be really good for the country and the people. We'll be discussing how these programs could be won. But first, David, tell us about your policy proposals.
Well, I'm glad to do that. The starting point was to try to understand why we have so much poverty. There are a lot of different ways to get at that, but our approach was fairly simple. We looked at the people who are poor and their relationship with the labor market. Most people get out of poverty by working, earning enough, and then when they retire, having enough combined with Social Security and savings to have a decent life. So we basically asked the question, are there enough jobs? Do people earn enough when they do work? And are there people who fall through the cracks of the disability system for those who can't work and the Social Security retirement system for those who've retired? And the answer to all those questions, Bill, was yes. Although there have been a few times in history where the number of people who want to work and the number of jobs that are available are roughly comparable. You think of, obviously, the Second World War, the end of the dot-com boom, things were pretty much evenly matched. But most of the time, there are significantly more people looking for jobs than there are jobs that are available in the labor market. In other words, a big part of poverty is that there just aren't enough jobs to go around. The problem is particularly visible when you go beyond the official unemployment measure and you actually look at all the people who are really unemployed who aren't counted. The unemployment measure is a very conservative measure. It requires you to have been actively looking for work for the last several weeks. So if you've given up because you've tried and couldn't get a job, or if you've got a few hours of work and you're mostly unemployed but you're just working a little bit, you're not even counted as unemployed. So the real number of unemployed has exceeded the supply of job openings by millions. Right now, there's about a 2 million gap, and that's using, again, the most conservative measure. The real number of unemployed for whom there literally would be no job if every single vacancy were filled is probably 3 or 4 million. So clearly, part of the problem is there just aren't enough jobs for people. An equal part of the problem is that a huge percentage of the jobs that people do find and fill don't pay enough. The wages are too low. And even in some cases, when you add on food stamps or the earned income tax credit or other government programs that sometimes are direct benefits, sometimes they're coming through the tax system, the disposable income that people have still leaves them below not only the official poverty line, but other measures of poverty that are often seen as more realistic. The third problem is that there clearly is in this society, like in any society, a group of people who can't work because they have a disability. They have a mental disability or a physical disability, either on a long-term or short-term basis. And we, like most societies, say we don't expect you to work. We provide disability benefits through several different programs. But there's a large group of folks who are getting disability benefits who still remain poor. In other words, the benefits are too low. And then finally, another group whom we don't expect to work, seniors who've retired age 65 or older, they have worked their whole life. They are retired workers, but the amount they get on Social Security plus their savings leave them below the poverty line.
That's a group that's going to really increase, in fact, in the next many years, as because companies are no longer funding decent pensions.
That's right. That we've moved almost entirely away from the so-called defined benefit pension programs that would guarantee you an income stream after years of work, and we move more and more into the programs based on your savings. The problem is that a lot of people don't save, and those that do, a fair number of them lost their shirt in the Great Recession. So even if they did everything right, a lot of it was wiped out by the near collapse of the economy during that period.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here talking to David Reamer, who's a public policy expert in many things, health and income programs and jobs. We've been talking about the reasons for poverty. David, tell us about the program that you've developed based on the understandings you gave us as to why there's poverty.
Sure.
And so much poverty in this country. There's so much money, and yet
right.
So many people are really dirt poor, and even more are enormously precarious, you know, one heartbeat away from destitution, it seems to me, for very large numbers of people.
Well, that's right. And before going into what we thought of as the solution, during the 50s and 60s, poverty was coming down. More and more people were getting work, and incomes were rising. But then around 1973, the music died, so to speak, and poverty has been pretty flat ever since. And then, as some experts have pointed out, the volatility of employment and income has gotten worse. So we consulted with some local experts, some national experts. The people I work with also have a lot of experience as community organizers, labor organizers. And we came up with a 5-point plan. The first part of it was simply to bring back government-funded jobs program. So these days, this kind of program is called transitional jobs or transitional employment. So the idea was, we said, let's put in place a policy that offers the unemployed or people who have less than 40 hours of work a guarantee of full-time employment at the minimum wage until they can find a regular job in the regular economy. The second policy was to raise the minimum wage. The national minimum wage has been stuck at $7.25 an hour for years. Some states and cities, and I know in Oregon you've been doing this, have raised it. But we basically said, let's see what happens if you raised it for the whole country. A third policy that we looked at was to increase something called the earned income tax credit. Back 20 years ago, if I used those words, most people would have not had an idea what it meant. But these days, a fair number of people know what the EITC or the earned income tax credit is. Essentially, it supplements your earnings. So if your earnings are below a certain level, the EITC is either a reduction in your taxes or it actually gives you a payment through the tax system that tops up your earnings up to certain specified levels, and then it phases out. The fourth policy that we looked at was to guarantee child care for people. A fair number of people who are looking for work or working have younger kids, or they're working second or third shift and their kids aren't in school, so they need to be able to have a safe and affordable place for their children. And then the fourth thing we did was we said we've got to increase the income of people getting disability benefits or Social Security if it's too low. So what we did was we developed these policies in great detail, and then we hired the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C., to test whether if you put these policies together, you could make a big impact on poverty. And the Urban Institute came back with some very, very interesting findings. And basically what they found was that if you put in place, through their very sophisticated modeling system, if you imagine that these policies were in place for the whole country, each individual policy would have a modest effect. But if you combined these policies, transitional jobs plus a higher minimum wage, plus a bigger EITC, plus child care, plus higher income for people with disability or Social Security benefits, you could cut the poverty rate by 50%, 60%, maybe 70%. It was dramatic.
And apparently, if people also take advantage of other programs like food stamps and things to the maximum, it would be close to 80% or more than 80%.
That's right. Although I think that, ironically, if people went to work more and earned more, in some cases, the benefits that they would get from food stamps and some of these other programs
would decline,
which is a good reason for welfare costs to decline. It's because you don't need them because people's incomes are high enough. So the conclusion that we reached, Bill, was that there's no reason why we need to have over 40 million poor Americans. There's no reason why we have to have poverty in double digits. This is a man-made or man and woman-made problem. And we can fix it by putting the right policies in place.
This is KBOO Radio, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to David Reamer. We've been discussing his program developed in Milwaukee with a lot of people and tested nationally, and at least tested analytically nationally. I don't think anybody has actually adopted all the provisions that would virtually end poverty. David, some people would say, why do all of that? In Switzerland, at least, an initiative to guarantee a national income narrowly failed. There are a lot of people talking about, in fact, that's really the way of dealing with poverty, especially as manufacturing is moving towards only robots. It's not clear that there are going to be full-time jobs for people. Maybe one of the things we'd want to do is just cut hourly work week to 30 hours. But we really do have to deal with the problem of just not enough work, which, of course, is also the Federal Reserve manages to keep pushing up interest rates, or they did for a long time, to make sure that there was not enough work by slowing the economy, which meant really the federal government was ensuring that 5 or 8 or 10 or 15% of the people went hungry and were destituted. Your program would end poverty. Why not go for the Swiss model and at least fight for that at the same time that you've fight for the 5 or 6 programs that you just enumerated?
Well, I do think that providing a guaranteed income makes sense for people who can't work because of a physical or mental disability that's pretty severe. And, of course, I think that for people who've reached retirement age as seniors, if for some reason Social Security and other savings are inadequate, that we need to increase their income so they're not poor. Another group I think that we should pay attention to are parents of newborn children or adopted children, perhaps adults caring for a senior who need resources while they're doing something very important for our society, caring for children, caring for someone who's frail or elderly. But on the whole, Bill, I feel pretty strongly that a general guaranteed income for all adults would be a mistake. And here are the reasons why. First of all, if you made it too low, it's not going to be enough. People are going to have to work anyway. If you made it high enough so that it's a decent income, made it $30,000 or $35,000 or $40,000, people will quit their jobs. There'll be a huge disincentive to work. But I think the more fundamental reason has to do with what human beings are. We are programmed as human beings to work. We are commanded to work through various religions. It's in our genes. It's in our culture. Lots of people want to work. Rather than tell people who have this need to work, well, we're not going to help you get work. We'll just give you money. Why not identify useful work to be done and offer that at a decent wage to people? You're correct that because of mechanization and trade and technology and lots of other things, it seems to be the case that for long stretches, the private economy isn't producing enough jobs for people. That's clearly true. But there's a lot of work to be done that's needed and useful above and beyond that which the labor market is willing to pay for.
But you pointed out that people do love to work. People really do want to contribute. That's really in our genes, to cooperate with others and build the society together. Businessmen say, if people were guaranteed an income, they would quit my job and live on that money. Well, they might quit his job and live on that money, but they would be doing things. They would look for other things to do which are useful and pleasurable and collaborative with other people. It seems to me that we have to move from an economy where people are forced to work by dint of going hungry at things that are really destructive of them and boring and routine and often the worst jobs, highly authoritarian, not all jobs, not even most, but many, many people only work at them because of that. We shouldn't have jobs like that. I mean, there's some work that's bad and that has to be done, so you reward it and make sure, have a draft for it, whatever it would be. But I don't think that the argument that we have to keep wages and benefits low so that people are forced to go into the workforce, that doesn't appeal to me, David. I mean, we're talking about the future and something that should happen that won't happen tomorrow, but we have to talk about. I think that we'd really want to do these more, quote, utopian proposals, not as substitutes for these more practical things that you could, might win, but it still seems to me we have to maintain that vision.
Well, I certainly agree with part of what you've said. I think we should make sure that jobs are available, that jobs pay well, that jobs aren't harmful physically in other ways to the workers. There's a lot of improvement that can be done to make workplaces even safer. At the same time, I think we should be honest about the fact that a lot of the things that we want in life involve a certain amount of repetition. There are in Milwaukee, I suspect there are in Portland, lots of people who would be willing to work in honest, safe, somewhat boring work in exchange for a decent wage, a decent income. I guess what I'd like to do is get to the point where everybody has work if they want it. Everybody has a decent income. Work is safe. Savings are structured so that when you retire, you have enough to live on, combined with Social Security. Continuing the kind of cultural pressure on the quality of work is important. What I don't think is a good idea is just giving everybody somebody else's money.
Which is called a demogrant. Let's call it a demogrant rather than giving people other people's money.
One of the other things that I have a problem with the guaranteed income is frankly just the politics of it. I've spent a lot of time doing door-to-door work, talking to voters in working class, middle class parts of the city of Milwaukee, which I suspect aren't too different than working class, middle class parts of Portland or any other city. And it's hard for me to imagine making the pitch to someone who I talk to at the doors to agree to the following proposition. you should work hard, maybe not at a job that you like. You should pay taxes. And some of that money should go to people who can work but just don't want to. They just want to get your money.
That's sort of the conservative line. It's a really interesting conversation, though. But there's a couple things, though, that we haven't talked about, which I want to give you a minute to talk about. And one of them is the role of the poor as part of a large coalition that would, in fact, in this very rich country, be able to enact the five or six programs that you discussed earlier in the interview. It seems to me that people free themselves from poverty not just by getting more income and more capacity to earn, but also by getting a much more positive sense of themselves, their capacities, their skills, their worth. And that's the product now of actually doing political stuff and being involved and fighting for yourself and recognizing that you and the people like you are worthy people and deserve the benefits of, in fact, contributing to the society. You get the last word. That's my hypothesis, that, in fact, we really need movements and struggles, and the poor have to be in major positions in those struggles. It can't be just bestowed by a progressive, decent government or a group of people. It has to be won, it seems to me, is the way, and that's the only way it could be won.
I totally agree with you, Bill. I think that achieving social and economic justice in this country does require movements, and I think that the people who are poor, unemployed, people who have faced discrimination need to be leaders in that movement. I think I told you earlier that my father, Neil Riemer, who passed away in 2001, was on the March on Washington in 1963, and he was in the throng of people listening to Dr. Martin Luther King speak about his dream. The official title of that march was March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. Dr. King understood that the movement that we need for justice in this country is partly a movement about civil rights, but it was partly also a movement about economic rights. And he was involved in bringing not only African Americans, but other low-income people into that movement. One final set of anecdotes I want to mention. Over the years, I've been involved in going to the state legislature to ask for the enactment of programs. We have a small transitional jobs program for unemployed people here in Wisconsin. There's a program that you have in Oregon that performs a similar function. We have a state supplemental earned income tax credit that we were able to persuade the legislature to enact, and you have a similar program recently increased in Oregon thanks to your state legislature. When we went to the legislators to ask for their enactment of these programs, it wasn't just me and other middle-class people with mastery of spreadsheets and the numbers. We went together with low-income people, and they were typically African-American, and it was their testimony, their stories about their lives and how they wanted to work and how getting a job helped transform them, how they needed enough money from their work to be able to support themselves and their kids. It was their stories and their requests that riveted the attention of policymakers. Had we not been working with them, had they not really in some ways been the lead speakers, we never would have gotten those small incremental measures of economic justice enacted. So this movement has got to involve the poor, the unemployed, minorities, as well as those of us who are in a more fortunate position and maybe have a little bit more technical knowledge. If it's just us making the case, we're not going to succeed. We've got to have a movement.
David Riemer, thanks a lot for talking to us today. It was really good. So long.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO-FM Portland. I'm Fran Michelle, and that was the late, great Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings doing White Christmas. And before that, Bill Resnick talking with David Riemer about alleviating poverty. To pursue some of Bill's remarks to his guests today, we might remember that even though freely chosen sensuous human endeavor is an important part of being human, alienated wage labor is not. we might take to heart comments from French activists protesting changes in unemployment law there some years ago. Taking a page from the Situationists, they protested that, quote, the best way to abolish unemployment is to abolish the work and the money linked with it. It is both morally and strategically justified to make particular demands, such as for higher unemployment benefits or free public services, but a social movement should not limit itself to such demands. To do so amounts to asking for justice from the very forces that are based on injustice. It's absurd to demand the creation of jobs. Enough riches already exist to take care of everybody's basic needs. They only need to be shared around. We don't want full employment. We want full lives. End quote. Audre Lorde, in her essay, Uses of the Erotic as Power, suggests that, quote, the principal horror of any system which defines the good in terms of profit rather than in terms of human need, or which defines human need to exclusion of the psychic and emotional components of that need, the principal horror of such a system is that it robs our work of its erotic value, its erotic power and life appeal and fulfillment. Such a system reduces work to a travesty of necessities, a duty by which we earn bread or oblivion for ourselves and those we love. End quote. It's no wonder that the system of wage slavery has, over the years, led some to call for the abolition of work, the refusal of work, the right to be lazy. Slackers and idlers, artists and anarcho-punks, those living on unemployment and those living with voluntary simplicity, we might see them all as resisting the mystification of wage slavery and the glorification of work. Paul Lafargue, the son-in-law of Karl Marx, argued for the right to be lazy. He asserts in the essay of that title that the dangerous delusion that the love of work brings the woes of the love of work brings the woes which for two centuries have tortured sad humanity under capitalism. Instead of opposing this mental aberration, the priests, the economists, and the moralists have cast a sacred halo over work. But if the working class were to arise, not to demand the right to work, but to forge a brazen law forbidding anyone to work more than 3 hours a day, the earth, the old earth, trembling with joy, would feel a new universe leaping within her. Lafargue concludes, O laziness, mother of the arts and noble virtues, be thou the balm of human anguish. Bertrand Russell similarly argues in his 1932 essay, In Praise of Idleness, that a great deal of harm is being done in the modern world by belief in the virtuousness of work. Franco Berardi, in his discussion of the Italian autonomist movement, notes that, quote, refusal of work means that the general transformation of social institutions are produced by the daily action of withdrawal from exploitation, of rejection of the obligation to produce surplus value and to increase the value of capital, reducing the value of life. Autonomy is the independence of social time from the temporality of capitalism. End quote. Bob Black, in his essay on the abolition of work, asserts that no one should ever work. Work is the source of nearly all the misery in the world. Almost any evil you'd care to name comes from working or from living in a world designed for work. In order to stop suffering, we have to stop working. Black defines work quite specifically as compulsory production enforced by economic or political means. But as Nila Schluening observes in her essay on the abolition of work and other myths, there are forms of work that are necessary without being compelled of individuals by chattel slavery or wage slavery. Schluening notes that, quote, much of the work to be done in any society is not a matter of choice. Seeds must be planted and tended, food gathered, stored, prepared, and cooked, fuel and shelter must be arranged for cooling and warmth, children must be tended, people must be healed, clothed. In much of the world, most of this work is done by women. Moreover, if we remain committed to our modern urban industrial societies, a vast infrastructure must be maintained and work must remain highly coordinated. Someone must do all this work. Cooperatively, individually, by lot, by coercion, the work must be done. Unquote. But as Schluening admits, we can certainly organize our work in a more meaningful way. As Audre Lorde suggested, the possibility of reclaiming the erotic value of at least some of our work, the possibility of meaningful work on the margins and in the interstices of capitalism, the possibility of erotically satisfying experience, whether it's dancing, building a bookcase, writing a poem, examining an idea, can give us the energy to pursue genuine change within our world. Or, as the heirs of the Situationists put it, whether we are workers, students, or unemployed, what we all really need is the space and time to meet, to share dreams, to recreate our lives. We should demand not full employment, but full enjoyment. And now, for some illumination on the question of who will be making those demands, we turn to Denise Morris.
Since the election of Donald Trump in November, everyone wants to know what's wrong with the white working class. The most dominant question being, did the white working class vote for or against their economic interests? In his recent article, The Invention of the White Working Class, Les Leopold, executive director of the Labor Institute, looks at the debate with an eye on historical definitions and social construction of race. This is an abridged version of a much longer article published on Huffington Post, 12/21/16. History warns us to be very careful when using the phrase white working class. It concerns the changing historical definitions of who is white. Eduardo Porter in the New York Times uses this construction to ask, quote, did the white working class vote its economic interests? Claiming that data shows white people losing out to blacks and Hispanics in getting their fair share of new jobs created since 2007. Porter further argues that this is happening because blacks and Hispanics live mostly in thriving urban areas, while most white people live in declining rural areas, and therefore believes that the white working class flocked to Trump as a way to protest their economic decline. But this conclusion is flawed. Neither the studies nor Porter provide a definition of white working class. Is it all white people? Does it include management, professionals? No evidence that the actual work experiences of white and black working people are starkly different, and no matter how the class is defined. Rural America is not lily white. Hispanics and African Americans make up a total of 17.5% of rural and small town America. Research shows that working people as a whole, defined as the 85% of us who are production and non-supervisory employees, have seen their real wages fall since the late 1970s, all shades, all colors. And finally, most of the new jobs created are low-wage, part-time service sector jobs, jobs that often pay poverty wages. So getting the lion's share of these jobs is not a pathway to prosperity. What these studies and reports do accomplish, however, is to sound the latest dog whistle about race in America. They create an image in our minds of a coherent white working class hunkered down in the declining manufacturing sector, white rural workers who have needs and interests different from black and brown urban workers. In doing this, the image feeds into a long history of white working class creationism that divides working people by race. A dramatic redefinition of white took place during the late 19th and early 20th centuries as mass immigration and colonialization expanded. So-called race scientists studied cranial size and shapes, skin color, and hair texture to create a biology of race. By 1911, the U.S. Immigration Commission published its Dictionary of Races and Peoples, listing 29 separate races. Race science defined white as a narrow category that excluded virtually everyone who didn't come from Northern Europe. By the First World War, U.S. immigration policy was informed by IQ tests given to immigrants on Ellis Island that supposedly showed, quote, 80% of Russians, 83% of Jews, 80% of Hungarians, and 79% of Italians were feeble-minded. These race scientists created a vast hierarchy of race for a Pittsburgh steel company in 1926. It is based on the idea that each race, by its intrinsic nature, possesses certain skills and attributes that make it suitable to certain work tasks. This science, quote-unquote, provided the rationale for dividing the workforce by ethnic group, which had the added virtue of weakening worker solidarity and keeping unions at bay. This became particularly acute after 4 million workers went on strike at the end of World War I. The largest strike involved 350,000 steelworkers that finally collapsed after 14 weeks of pitched battles. It is highly likely that the skills chart was designed to prevent such a resurgence. A confluence of events rapidly changed the definition of white in the 1930s and 40s. The rise of American industrial unionism successfully organized, quote, unskilled immigrant workers, blacks, and Hispanics into broad-based unions. The mobilization for World War II further melded together all the, quote, lower ethnic groups except for black, brown, and yellow. And after the atrocities at the Nazi death camps were revealed, the earlier race science industry was thoroughly discredited. What causes the definition of race to change? The definition of white and race in general depends on the needs of the most powerful elements in society. To justify slavery and Jim Crow, race science gave Southern elites a justification for denying human rights to millions with darker skin colors. To successfully mobilize America against the, quote, master race and yellow peril during World War II, American leaders permitted white to be broadened to include most of what previously had been considered lesser races. However, racist Southern Democrats and their lockdown control of Congress made sure that black and brown people were denied New Deal benefits and therefore would continue to suffer as separate races. The Japanese internment camps further heightened the idea of a separate race of, quote, Orientals. Is race real? Citing the article Confusions About Human Races by R.C. Lewontin, Leopold continues, every effort to construct a black or white race through genetics has failed. No one yet has found a gene that signals a separate race. 85% of all genetic variation among people within a population and only 15% of the variation among humans is between different populations and continents. Biologically speaking, the old cliche is true. There is only one race, the human race. What is race? Over a century ago, W.E.B. Du Bois put forth perhaps the clearest, most exact definition of race. Quote, a Negro is a person who must ride Jim Crow in Georgia. He understood, as we should, that race always is a social construction, a human invention used to create a hierarchy of power. It is not genetics, it is not biology, and in the case of the white working class, it's not even accurate sociology. Drop the dubious white working class construction, and we'll see that it's not whether the imagined white working class voted for its own economic interests by voting for Trump. Rather, the real question is it even possible for working people of all kinds to vote their economic interests given the corporate orientation of both parties? The invention of the white working class can be found online at Huffington Post, 1221-16. Les Leopold is the director of the Labor Institute. His new book is Runaway Inequality, An Activist Guide to Economic Justice. This has been Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
That was, of course, Billy Bragg letting us know that race hatred cannot stop us because, as Denise Morris explained just before that, we know and will tell others that not only is the working class far more diverse than corporate media recognizes, but we will work to resist the racist divisions created to serve the interests of capital. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. Our engineer is Joe Clement. Finally on today's show, we turn to Laurie Mercier and Hyung Nam to find out more about the work of getting our urban population together and powerful.
Thanks, Fran. I'm here with activist, educator, and organizer Hyung Nam, and we'll be talking about ways of building progressive power at the local level and transforming our cities as a means for challenging and transforming state and federal power. Thanks for stopping by KBOO, Hyung.
Thanks for having me.
Last week on The Old Mole, you chatted with Denise Morris about the city's Socially Responsible Investments Committee, which serves as one model of how residents can change the way cities do business through divesting from corporations associated with fossil fuels and human rights violations. But you've also been studying and participating in other movements that might provide some guidance for the many groups protesting Trump's election in cities across the country. So let's talk about some of these models for taking charge of our cities and reforming them, revising them, revolutionizing them in ways that really serve the interests of the majority. So are there some models that you want to talk about here that might serve as some guidance?
Yeah. There are several models, and, one recent model that I think many of us are very excited about and we're studying, and I mean people all over the country and the world are studying, is the Barcelona and Camus model, which organized people within neighborhoods and communities and linked them up together to create a people's platform and win the city. And it included everything from the social movements of the not only Podemos, but the May 15th movement that happened within the squares, and also housing rights movements, where they actually worked together and elected Ada Colau, who is a housing rights activist. And so we also have models like the Richmond Progressive Alliance, which has been battling against Chevron for years and elected people to as mayor and city council to push for and actually have power to implement progressive reforms. We also have the Cooperative Jackson model that Choki Lumumba started. And in fact, one of the organizers there that's continuing that work, Kali Okuno, took a delegation to Barcelona, Spain, to learn from what they're doing there, as we are here too.
So that's Richmond, California, Jackson, Mississippi. So how are these communities, how have they been able to reform their cities? And it sounds like both through electoral politics, but also in galvanizing various social movements coming together to challenge the status quo and corporations that tend to dominate city structures.
Absolutely. It is, and I think that's the whole crux of it, is combining the power of organizing social movements, but also going after winning institutional power, especially in cities, to really make the kind of changes. So, for example, when we mentioned the divesting and the Socially Responsible Investments Committee, it's not enough for us just to win things like taking our money out of bad investments like Wells Fargo or Caterpillar. We also have this immense potential to use the, control the $2.7 billion budget of our city. And, we could use part of that not only for municipal public banking, we could use part of that for participatory budgeting and having people democratically decide how we're going to spend this money. So, for instance, we don't end up being like a city like Los Angeles, where out of a $100 million budget to deal with houselessness in Skid Row, $87 million of that is used for policing to criminalize the houseless, which is, the same kind of thing is happening here in Portland. So in a lot of ways, I really want to push back and critique this patting themselves on the back by these neoliberal Democrats that run most of these cities that, claim that we're a sanctuary city. We need to be a rebel city. And that means acknowledging the deep problems of gentrification, inequality, and so on in these cities, and do much more than just resist Trump.
And I think that's an important clarification to make here, because I think one of the major ways people have thought about the potential power of municipalities, of cities, has been in the wake of many city leaders claiming that these places will be sanctuary cities in response to Trump's election and the threats against immigrant residents, that cities will serve as sanctuaries. But when we think about it, most American cities are far too expensive for most immigrants. And I mean, what's another way to think about sanctuary in quotes?
Well, you know, I think one critique of sanctuary that we should have is right now our cities, especially cities like Portland, Seattle, San Francisco, New York City, are sanctuaries for capital. There's basically a giant pool of money sloshing around in the world, including corrupt criminal money, institutional investors, Wall Street, and political, you know, political oligarchy money that's investing and parking their money in housing. Or, you know, example, Uber just started their fleet of self-driving cars in San Francisco. They evicted a houseless camp so that they could park their cars, right? So we have to critique that as well. And I think, you know, going beyond just critiquing it to actually change this, we have to organize people within cities to win power so that we don't just, you know, ask these neoliberal career politicians to make these minor changes or reforms. We actually have a radical democracy where people organize and take power and, you know, revision and reimagine and recreate our cities democratically.
Well, speaking of the housing crisis and the lack of affordable housing for people, what might be a way in which people of Portland might make it a city that is more diverse economically? Because, as you pointed out earlier, it is becoming a city of many six-figure income people.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think this, we have an immense opportunity right now. I mean, the election outcome has been horrible in so many different ways. But at the same time, we have this opportunity to really make use of this and say that, well, if we, liberals are saying that we want to be a sanctuary city, let's be a sanctuary city and not only be defiant against federal orders to cooperate with ICE and deportations, let's also be defiant against the state preemptions on rent control, against state preemptions on real estate transfer taxes, and not only that, right, take control of our city's money and create things like a municipal public bank. And, you know, we could have much more funding and money to create publicly owned housing, actually affordable housing. We could create democratically run worker co-ops to do, you know, create public green public goods, just like the Evergreen Co-op system is doing.
Because right now, the way affordable housing is defined by the city is really housing for the upper middle class. And so citizens can really reshape the way housing is defined, how it's owned, how it's apportioned, much more democratically. You know, another way in which cities provide opportunity as well as repression is in terms of the militarization of police. So while cities provide spaces for the kind of flowering, mushrooming of various social movements, and we can think about the Occupy movement of some years ago, although cities provided spaces for those movements, also crush them in terms of the increasing paramilitarization of police forces. So how might a more democratically run city actually have policing?
Yeah, you know, and I think it's important to see the connection between policing and urban politics, right? The police serve a purpose. I mean, the police do not, you know, protect the public or keep peace. The police basically serve the interests of capital in our cities. So we have to see the connection between policing and gentrification, property values, and so on. So, you know, one of the things that one of the groups that I'm here today not speaking for, but as a participant observer, very excited about is the Portland Assembly that wants to be kind of a container to create coalitions of these social movements that could win power and make these kind of changes. But one of the things that Tyler from Portland Assembly talks about often is the Portland Development Commission. So there's an example of how currently, under this neoliberal city, what happens with our property taxes, or when anyone in the city pays their rent that goes towards property taxes, or their water bill, or their parking fees, or whatever, part of that money goes to what's called tax increment financing, right? So that money funds these urban renewal projects that have been basically gentrification projects for neoliberal development within our cities. So I think it's important to see the role that the police play is to enable that kind of a design of a city, rather than keeping the peace. So I think as problematic it is, or as problematic the police is, and no doubt we have to win power in the city so that we can actually have some people that have a spine to make some serious changes to policing. But I think it's also important to see that the police serve a function, which is not to protect the peace or serve the public, but serve the interests of capital and this growing inequality in cities like Portland and all these other cities that have declared themselves sanctuary cities.
So since the Portland Assembly held its first gathering a few weeks ago, what were some ideas, resolutions, actions that came out of that seemed promising?
Yeah, first of all, I just want to back up and say that there's been just such an incredible upsurge of goodwill, not only in the people that I met in organizing Portland Assembly, just putting so much time and energy into this, but just so many people stepping forward after these elections saying that they want to get involved, they want to do something. People that have never done anything like this before, people that had been kind of dormant for the last 20 years, all coming forward. And so what Portland Assembly is doing, and by the way, we will be having, we had our our first assembly just a couple weeks ago, and then we'll be having our first spokes council on January 28th. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to organize people, all these people that have good intentions and goodwill, combining new people and experienced organizers to work together and organize around affinity groups. And, some things are kind of in the process of change right now. I think one way that we're going forward is to create neighborhood-based groups that will be grassroots democratic groups that can be, whose voices and decisions can be empowered together through a spokes council system where we come together and we can actually win power in the city and come up with policy changes, come up with candidates that could win power in the city and make the kind of changes that we need about urban renewal, about policing, about so many of the other kind of issues that we were struggling with even before Trump was elected.
So how do people get involved?
Well, I think the first thing to do is go to the website to start looking at the materials that are out there, and that is portlandassembly.com. And they have some really fantastic materials on their website for people to start understanding what are the kind of problems that we're addressing here in the city, what are some of the other groups that are involved in this project, and what are some of the goals that this organizing has in building these coalitions. And I have to say, from my experience working with the people that have organized this and people stepping forward and joining, it's been really fantastic. People have such good intentions. They are embracing and wanting to build coalitions and work together, and really there's so much hope here.
And this is both hope in terms of expanding social movements in the city, but also in changing the electoral makeup of the city that actually gives people some power to institute some of these changes we'd like to see happen.
Absolutely. And I think there's a lot of hope because, you know, as problematic as some of the decisions city council has been here because of the organizing in the city. I mean, we've won some really fantastic resolutions, like publicly financed city elections that will help for this kind of a project in the future. Also, you know, having created that social responsible investments committee and divesting from some of these bad investments, but also stopping the expansion of fossil fuel infrastructure and so on. So with those kind of things, if we can organize people, there is so much hope for us to have a truly democratic rebel city that will go beyond this neoliberal sanctuary city.
And then moving beyond this one rebel city, how do we expand outward, not only to our neighbors in Vancouver, Washington, or Hood River, but also region-wide and then nationwide? What's the end point here?
Yeah, you know, I think that is conceived in a few different ways. One is many folks in Portland Assembly are really into Murray Bookchin's libertarian municipalism that is wanting to create these kind of democratic systems within cities to have a confederation of mutual aid with other cities doing the same thing. But also people like Gar Perovitz talks about what he calls a checkerboard strategy, that nationally the system is so rigged that if we can create these positive, hopeful, real working examples, that will be a model for other cities and states as well to create similar kind of projects and mutually aid each other, and for those changes to eventually not only expand horizontally but to move up as well. But I just want to say that it's important for us to not ignore the rural areas. I think groups like the Rural Organizing Project are extremely important, and we have to remember that from cities, the organizing that we do here, we also need to aid and help the organizing there as well.
Thanks so much, Hyung Nam, for stopping by today and for all your work. This is Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you.
And that is it for today's Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO Portland. Thanks to Bill Resnick and his guest David Reamer for their discussion about reducing poverty. Thanks to Denise Morris for her comments on the so-called white working class. Thanks to Laurie Mercier and Hyung Nam for their conversation on municipal activism. Thanks to Joe Clement for being our engineer today. I'm Fran Michel. I've been your host. In a day or so, you can find the whole show as well as individual segments posted on our webpage at kboo.fm/program/old-mole-variety-hour. So you can listen to them again or send them to your friends. Subscribe to our podcast. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Become a member of KBOO Portland. All from kboo.fm/old-mole-variety-hour. Tune in again next Monday for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's underground perspective. Coming up on KBOO later today at 10 o'clock, right after this, on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein welcomes Ben Schreiber from Friends of the Earth to talk about Trump's rogues gallery of cabinet picks and the damage they might do to the very agencies they're being tasked to lead. At 11, we present the Arctic Report Card, how the melting Arctic might affect the rest of the world. At 11:30, it's Voices for the Animals, giving you three compelling reasons to go vegan in the new year. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
Taking you to faraway places,
Simon says,
and bringing them home to you.
Cha-cha-cha.
It's the Tiki Cha-Cha Club, KBOO's all-vinyl guilty pleasure. Monday nights, midnight to 1 a.m. on 90.7 FM stereo and around the world at kboo.fm.
And it is now 10 o'clock. Listen to KBOO. Portland, 90.7. Next, you have Locust Focus. After that, you have Health Watch.